for those in medicine, you know how important as a first year medical school you think about anatomy lab and how important it's going to be to have the right anatomy lab part. And I knew that from having worked at Mass General and having worked with a lot of Harvard medical students and hearing a lot of stories about anatomy. And I'm sitting in the back of the room looking at this sea of white men in the South, in the segregated South, wondering how am I going to survive this?
That was Vivian Pinn, who became the first full-time director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at NIH in 1991. In 1982, she was the first African-American woman to chair an academic pathology department in the United States at Howard University College of Medicine. In this podcast, she speaks with Robert Wynn, guest editor of The Cancer Letter and the Cancer History Project during Black History Month. In 1967, Pinn became the second Black woman to graduate from the University of Virginia School of Medicine. In this conversation, she talks about the obstacles she faced as a medical student, how she incidentally helped integrate restaurants in Charlottesville in the 1960s, and her beginnings as a research fellow in immunopathology at NIH.
So I'll start off by sort of saying, Dr. Pinn, that I am so happy and appreciative that you agreed to do this interview with me. As I said before, there are less than a handful of people who really are not just role models for me, but inspire me. And I literally try to figure out how you did what you did and to keep doing it. And I'm just grateful you agreed for the interview today. I'm just going to open this up with just sort of saying to you that, hopefully as a hip hop song would go, you know, at the end of this, for those who don't know, now they're going to know. And so, Dr. Pinn, if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yourself, but I'm going to ask the big question, like, how did you get into medicine anyways?
Well, you know, I think I sort of got interested in medicine when I was a young child. They tell me, I said I wanted to be a pediatrician at age 4, and I've said this before, but it's true. My parents both worked, so I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and especially my father's parents both were ill. My grandmother had diabetes, needed insulin shots. That was a big deal back in the 40s. And then my grandfather was suffering from colorectal cancer and had to get pain injections. And I remember my father was the only one of the children of his sisters and brothers who had the nerve to give a needle. It was considered a big deal then. And my grandfather said, I was the oldest grandchild, you know, teach Vivian. So I learned how to give needles to my grandmother and grandfather at a very young age, well, with my father overseeing it. And one thing I noticed was that everybody was in pain and suffering, but that was the time when you had house calls, general practitioners came to your home. And when the doctor came and took care of my grandmother, my grandfather, when he left, he was smiling. My grandparents were smiling. Everybody in the house was smiling. Everybody felt better. And it just seemed to me that the doctor was making everybody feel much better. And I liked that. I don't like suffering, but I felt, especially from being with my grandparents, that I had a knack for being around people who were suffering to make them feel better. And just witnessing what a doctor could do, that's what I wanted to do. So that was how I told I was around 4, I guess around that age. And I just stuck with it. The only other thing I ever considered doing was being a dancer or a singer. And I can't dance and I can't sing. So I was left with medicine as my only other career path that I had thought about. And that's how I did. And just with a lot of illness in my family, I lost my mother when I was a sophomore in college from a chondrosarcoma of her hip, which was never diagnosed by her physician. He treated her for poor posture with gold shots for arthritis and Oxford shoes. And I remember going to the doctor with her that summer and him. She was a very shy person. In those days, I was shy. I wish I'd been there now. And he said to her, Francina, you wouldn't be having these pains if you wore those shoes and did your exercises like I told you. And I went off to take my summer physics to go to Indianapolis. And at the end of the summer, on the day of my final exam, got a message from my mother. She was having surgery. My father had palpated a mass in her hip. And it turned out she had a chondrosarcoma of her iliac area that had actually grown through the bone That orthopedist must never have taken an x-ray. He couldn't have worked up. He was, because it had grown through the bone and found really by my father. So that was in college. And if nothing else, that just confirmed that I really wanted to be a physician and I wanted to do research. I'm not sure I really knew what research was, but in those days you really thought, I want to do research because I want to find an answer for this cancer thing. We want to cure cancer and I want to be a researcher. And I went back to complete my last 2 years of college and then off into a research position and then to medical school and some nice little challenges at UVA, which you probably are aware of. But the rest of my life, really just dedicated to those experiences I had in my early years.
So, you know, when it comes to, I mean, even beyond cancer, I mean, you know, how did you choose your field? Not just as a doctor, but you went in and you went in deep to, you know, pathology research. How did you get there?
Yeah, my father, I did not grow up saying I wanted to be a pathologist, but this is an interesting story because my father was tickled. I heard he was going around town showing pictures of me doing autopsies because he told me he didn't know how, when I was scared to go to cemeteries and go to funeral homes, how in the world did I pick pathology? But at the same time, he was evidently tickled inside. But you know, I told you that my mother died and I took a semester out of college to take care of my mother. And I took care of her doing so. I've been a real caregiver for 6 months, 24/7, taking care of my mother. Other than my grandparents, a real caregiver experience, taking care of my mother from washing sheets to giving meds to just consoling. And so when I went back to college, I went back to college the day after her funeral in February of that, so 61. I had a semester to make up from having been out of school for a semester. So while I marched with my class, the class of 62 at Wellesley, I had a semester to make up. And I decided I wanted to stay in Boston because there wasn't much I could do at home in Lynchburg. I'd worked as a nurse's aide in the hospital. I'd worked in the drugstore, you know, for the local druggist. And there wasn't much else to do. So I wanted to stay in Boston. So the first place that the Wellesley Student Placement Office gave me to go interview was at Mass General with the transplant surgeon. And even though he was looking for a research assistant, and even though he knew I'd be going back to school, I was fortunate because he took me on and sort of took me under his wing. So with him was Dr. Benjamin Barnes, working with Dr. Paul Richardson in the transplant center at MGH. And the pathologist with him, the immunopathologist, was Dr. Martin Flax. And as you may, it probably was before your time, but this is 1962. And in 1962, transplantation was considered, it was research. Remember, they were only doing it on living related relatives, mainly just for good pastures, and experimenting on how to make them survive longer and develop cadaver donors. So I got that summer job, and then they kept me, and I worked through while I finished my semester at Wellesley and stayed there until I went to start UVA Medical School in the fall. And I made the decision to go back to UVA because it was close to my father because I was an only child. And as I said, we lost my mother. But I was fortunate because every summer, those two guys brought me back to Mass General to work. And one summer, the surgeon didn't have money for our own. They gave me a research project of my own. And one summer, he didn't have the money for a research project for me alone. So the pathologist said, you know, well, I'll take care, I'll support her. So I still was working with both of them, but I was based in pathology. And my senior year, I took 6 months at Mass. I mean, UVA was tough. I mean, I'm a real big alum supporter right now. But in those days, there were some rough times. I got through, but there were some rough times. And I said to them, I really got to take some time away so I can survive mentally. And so they did allow me to take 6 months of my senior year, including summer, in a research position at Mass General. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to do because I knew working with Dr. Flax and working with Dr. Barnes, I knew all about transplantation or thought I did. I could diagnose it. I was starting to do the diagnoses at Mass General on kidneys and transplants. And I thought, you know, I was looking at prostate and I mean, I was really into GU because that's what my boss did. But not many places were taking women in surgery, and they certainly weren't thinking about women in urology. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was at a cocktail party, believe it or not, of the New England Society of Pathologists. Dr. Benjamin Castleman, who was then the chair of pathology at Mass General and who is legendary in his in the field of pathology. And he walked up to me, and of course I was quaking because here is the great Dr. Castleman. And he comes up to me and he says, Vivian, what are you going to do next year? Meaning for my internship. And I didn't know what to say. And this resident standing beside me said, oh, she must have been a pathologist. True story, this happened. I can tell you his name right now. And Dr. Castleman looked at me and said, well, why didn't you tell me? And Arthur, standing beside me, said, she's too shy. So Dr. Castleman said, if you're interested, come in my office and talk to me. So I'm standing there quaking and I'm thinking, you know, there is no way this little black girl from not a Harvard college, not a Harvard a med school graduate. I'm out of UVA, this little black girl from the country in Virginia, and I'm spending some time here, but there's no way I'm going to get an internship at the Mass General Hospital. So I didn't say anything. And one day he walked through the lab and said, Vivian, come in my office. And he said, are you really interested? And I said, I would love to do this. And he said, have your dean send me a letter of recommendation. And in those days, we didn't have cell phones, and I was poor. I can remember to this day, he had the secretary let me use the department's phone to call my dean at UVA to ask him for a letter. And I can remember I spoke to Dr. Miller, and he said, a letter of recommendation for you? And I said, yes, he wants a letter of recommendation for me. And a few weeks later, Dr. Castleman walked through the lab and said, oh, by the way, Vivian, we'll see you in July. Didn't go through the matching program. And it turns out that what he gave me, which affected my whole career, the rest of my life, I became an NIH research fellow, an acting intern, an acting resident on an NIH research fellowship. Paid $300 a month, no taxes, $300 a month. That was my salary for my 3 years of training there, but it was an NIH fellowship, and that's how I got into the field. My boss that I was working with, Dr. Flax, went off on sabbatical during my internship year and left me to cover the transplant and kidney biopsy service. So that's where I really got into it, got to know the folks at the other hospitals in Boston, and ended up in that area. And when Dr. Flax went to Tufts to build his new department, I went to Tufts. All right, I gave you a paragraph instead of a sentence response. But to me, it's sort of interesting how one thing has built on another in my life, just sort of happenstance and things that have happened. If Dr. Casman hadn't walked up and if Arthur hadn't told him I wanted to be a pathologist, I would never have been in that field. I would have been looking for something closer to home that I felt that maybe I could get. And that's why when I'm mentoring students or speaking to students, I tell them, reach for the stars. Because if you don't reach for it, you don't know if you're going to get there. If you don't aim for it, you'll never know if there was a possibility you would have it. And just learn from the lessons of my life. It can make a difference for others.
Well, you know what? You talk about some divine intervention. I am so glad that you wound up in pathology. So, just so you know. So, quick, going back just for a second before we move a little bit forward, and I know you glossed over it, but it must have been rough. In the 60s, you were both African American and a woman. So, give me a
That's
little
right.
bit of experience, because, right now we talk about medical schools being 50-50. I look back in the records, it wasn't 50-50 men and women. So, give me just a sense back then about how
Well,
good.
I came back from Boston after finishing college and my year of working at Mass General to go to medical school at the University of Virginia. I walked into the classroom, and I remember the auditorium in the old medical building at UVA. I didn't know a soul there. I walked up and sat in the back of the auditorium and waited for the rest of the class to come. I didn't see anybody else that looked like me, but I figured, well, for once I'm on time. The other women and other people of color must be late. And then they called the roll. And I'm sitting in the back and I see everybody's there. Now, remember, I went to a women's college, and here I am all of a sudden in the back in the South because Charlottesville was just starting to integrate. It was not integrated when I came back in 63. UVA was still an all-male school except for nurses and those in graduate school. Remember, they didn't start taking women in the undergraduate school at UVA until in the 70s after I had long finished medical school because I finished in 67. And so women, and of course minorities, that's another story. We know they'd only had a trickle here and a trickle there. I'm not quite sure how I got in, but I did. And so at for those in medicine, you know how important as a first year medical school you think about anatomy lab and how important it's going to be to have the right anatomy lab part. And I knew that from having worked at Mass General and having worked with a lot of Harvard medical students and hearing a lot of stories about anatomy. And I'm sitting in the back of the room looking at this sea of white men in the South, in the segregated South, wondering how am I going to survive this? When the dean says, okay, it's time for coffee break. There's coffee in the lounge down the hall, and I want you all to go there, and I want you to get yourselves into groups of four for anatomy lab. Well, I almost melted into my seat, and I thought, I don't know any of these guys. They know each other through fraternities, through their parents, through their schools, or just have connections that I don't have. I'm going to end up with the dumbest folks in the class who else don't get partners because nobody's going to want to take on in Charlottesville at this point a black woman as a lab partner. And I really was thinking when I left the back, I was not going to go down to that coffee lounge. I was still a little shy then, and I wasn't going to go down. And I was thinking maybe I should just go on down, get in my old car, and drive home and tell my father, I just don't see how I could do this because it's going to be tough enough being a medical student. And now I'm not going to have lab partners. And as I was walking down from the back, these two guys in the front of the auditorium yelled up and said, hey, Vivian, you want to be our lab partner? Now, somebody questioned me saying, how did they know your name was Vivian? I don't know. They may have said, hey, boo, I don't know. But at least they yelled out to me, and I can remember they yelled out and asked if I wanted to be their lab partner. And I went, well, yes, because all of a sudden that gave me somebody to connect with. They said, well, we'll get a fourth guy, and this will be our group. Let's go get coffee. I would never have gone to coffee. They took me to coffee. When it came time for the break to go for lunch, they took me across the street, and so I had my group. When Barbara Starks, who was the first, I was the second black woman at UVA. Barbara Starks was the first black woman in the class ahead of me. When she came back, she asked me where had I been eating because it had been a thing for black students at UVA that they mostly ate in the cafeteria because most of the restaurants were still segregated. And I said, I've been eating across the street on the corner. For those who don't know UVA, the street across from the medical school is called the corner. It's really just a street, but it's referred to as the corner. And I told her I'd been eating on the corner, and she said, you couldn't have been. They're not integrated yet. And I said, well, they are now because I've been eating there. And it took me maybe 30 years before I told my lab partner that, Kenny, you didn't know it, but you played a role in civil rights because you helped to integrate the restaurants on the corner in Charlottesville without even realizing what you were doing. So you could add that if you want or hide it if you want, but you played a role in civil rights because we integrated some of those restaurants and nobody knew. But I used that almost all these instances in my life I've drawn conclusions from. Reflect back 80 years, you think on things. And so one of my, everybody talks about inclusion and belonging. And I say that's a perfect example because if those guys hadn't reached out to me, I might well have just tucked tail and gone home thinking it's going to be too much of a challenge for me and too stressful. But they reached out to me, and what a difference that made in my life. And so one of my messages when I'm talking, and you're getting my messages point by point, is to look out for someone who may be different when you're in a room or in a group or in a gathering, because the smallest of gesture can make a big difference. That small gesture really made a big difference for me. And it probably was 20 or 30 years after graduating before I really realized the significance, the significance of that gesture. And so I have thanked Kenny. The other guy, unfortunately, is no longer alive, but the other two are. And we are still friends, and we still communicate after almost over 50 years, because and he jokes and says, when I tell that story, says, "Oh, I just went to an all-male school, and I just want to have a pretty girl in my lab group." And he dismisses it. But you know what? You think about it, it took nerve for those white guys in the
Nerve.
segregated medical school to
Man.
reach out and ask the only black woman. They didn't know whether I was dumb or smart or what, to
Yes.
have me work with them. And I was lucky, because it turned out they were two of the smartest guys in the class. So I ended up with a wonderful lab group. But that was like, it just seemed to me so many things happened along my life that I just have to give credit up above or somewhere. Somebody was looking out for me, because so many things made a difference.
Oh, that would, you know, that, I'm gonna put an exclamation point on that. That's real allyship at that point. And the fact that you all subsequently have just done amazing work is just is a testament to not only, as you say, person up above, but humanity, when people can look beyond what we are and just sort of say, let's get the job done. Now, I got a question for you. Now, listen,
Sure.
when you talk about what you, if you look back over your career from the academic and your contributions to science, what would you say you're the most proud about, or what the proudest moment of your contributions to academe or research and that kind of stuff?
Well, you know, I think when I was a resident mass general, I saw a different side of medicine. I saw academic medicine, because you don't know much about academic medicine, you don't get that exposure. And
True.
I saw that academic medicine is where research is done, where decisions are made, where doors to medicine are being opened, where articles are being published that determine who gets what treatments. And I just fell in love with academic medicine. And that was during the time when everybody was promoting blacks in medicine by saying, you know, we want more blacks so they can go back to their communities to practice. And I started pointing out, well, our communities are not just the ghettos and the barrios. Our communities are everywhere that medicine is, including academic institutions, including insurance companies, including public health positions. And so I really just fell in love and started promoting this aspect of, when you're thinking about, I didn't get back to my hometown to practice medicine, but I did everything I could to encourage those who were in primary care to
Yeah.
think about my hometown and other small towns to go back. But I think that then, looking over my life, the things that I'm proudest of are not, I've got lots of honors and awards, and my plaques are all in the storage unit. I'm paying to protect them, because I don't want to throw them away. But what do you do with plaques when you get to my age and don't have an office for them? But what I am proudest of is seeing the accomplishments of those I have taught or mentored or just seen along the way. I can't take credit for what they've all done, but when I hear from students I had in the 70s or the 80s, I just heard from a Howard student I had 35 years ago, who reminded me of a program that's going on today at Emory, where she's going to be speaking, but reminded me I was the first speaker. And I hear from her. When I hear from my former students, it means so much to me. I've had students who've been presidents of universities, not only in the US, but outside the US. Those who show me the, who've had the largest practices. Look at Malcolm Taylor, who was one of my first students at Tufts, and his group was the largest Black group of cardiologists in the country for a while. I don't know if it still is, but when I see, and so many of the Black doctors in Jackson, Mississippi at one time were graduates of Tufts that I happen to have been able to put my fingers on. So when I look at the accomplishments of those that have come through me or around me or maybe just passed by me, I am just so proud of them, because they've reached prominence in ways that I never could have. But the fact that most of them at least remember who I am, and I just can just be proud. I'm like a parent. All my former students, all my former residents, since I don't have children of my own, I think they've just sort of become like my extended family. And that's what I'm proud of. So, oh, I love my awards and I love the honors. That's great, but they can put on a piece of paper hung on your wall. What means something is seeing that there are people who are contributing to society, who are contributing to the well-being of others. And that's what I mean. And not just Blacks, Hispanic, I mean, Asian American. I mean, I've got a variety, a diversity of former students, but even those who are not minority, who are contributing to the scholarship fund in my name at Tufts, or who still recognize me. So, you know, it shows that you hang around long enough just seeing the benefits of those who learn from your mistakes. And I like to point out to those, you know, remember and think about the things that were negative findings in your career, because they can be as important as the positive things, because you learn from those and you learn to not be like those that were negative in your life. So to me, it's important. There's another one of my pearls of wisdom. It's important to recount not just the positive episodes, but the negative episodes, so that you don't recreate those negative episodes for others.
Oh, that's so cool. You know, and by the way, I don't even think it would be revisionist history to say your star was burning bright the whole time. So listen, people know who you are. So now listen, you were right around the time, and I just have to ask. I know you were right around the time with the Heckler Report and issues around health
Oh,
equity
I
and
remember when the
health.
Heckler Report was being written, because it really was mostly written by Tom Malone, who was a deputy director at NIH. Did you know that? And
I did
Herb
not know.
Nickens assisted him. Tom Malone was a deputy director. And I knew Tom Malone because his wife, when I was at Howard, his wife was the head of my cytology section. So he would come to visit his wife and stop in to see me. So I saw drafts of that Heckler report before it was done. And when it was done, he gave me a complete set of the Heckler report, all the volumes. It's not just one volume, as you know, there are many volumes. And he gave me copies of all the volumes. And that was prior to 91, before I went to NIH. So many of us who know that refer to it as the Malone report, but it really was Tom Malone, who was a scientist extraordinaire, wonderful individual who was at NIH, who really put that report together. And Herb Nickens, who most people have heard of, Herb
Yes.
Nickens contributed to that. And one of the phrases that's most often quoted from that report, that is that patients seem to relate better to physicians who are like them. Herb confided in me that actually he was the one that put that language into the report. See, you'd be around a long time. I've been around a long time. I got a few inside stories from just having been around that long.
Oh, my
But
goodness.
it's interesting, that report came out and no one paid much attention to it until Lew Sullivan became secretary and he started referring to it, and people treated it like it was a brand new report. I have to give Sullivan credit because he really pulled it out of obscurity. And that's when people first began really paying attention to it, because they didn't give it that much attention. They knew Heckler released it and it just sort of went off and sat on shelves. And Lew brought it and made it a living force. And since then, you hear people refer to it all the time.
So can you tell me in the context of the evolution of health equity, because it sounds as if we were fairly segregated, and then all of a sudden, we had the science and lots of things around technology. This buzz or this process around health equity, what other, because I was thinking about people like also during that period of time, Jane Cook Wright, and I mean you
Oh,
all
yes.
pioneers. Y'all were pioneers, pioneers,
Yes.
pioneers.
Oh, I look up to her. Well, she really was a pioneer. Yes.
Oh my God. And so as you think about how this conversation around health equity sort of came about, certainly the report, the Heckler report, but there must have been other awarenesses or consciousness that actually brought
Well,
this.
you have to credit that report, because all of us had thought. And we all talked about and said, you know, more people, more Black women are dying of breast cancer. More Black men have prostate cancer. We see more heart disease. We see more diabetes. But it had never really been documented. And so the fact that the Heckler report documented it had resources. It had, what's the word I want, references, and it had data, true data. It wasn't all just something that was observational. But examples, in the Heckler report was the first time we really had a true collection of data from the federal government. Remember, this is coming from the federal government, so it couldn't be accused of being biased, that documented what we had all thought. So that kind of became our Bible in terms of being able to quote, and here's the data. We've been telling you for years that We are sicker, but here's data that shows that that is true. Here are some examples. Here are some facts. And that's what made the difference. And Lew Sullivan used that to the nth degree in his speeches. He was the first person. I mean, Herb Nickens used to talk about it, Tom Malone, but it was the Heckler Report, but they would use it. But it was Sullivan as Secretary of Health and Human Services in that position. I have to give him credit. I give credit where credit's due. Don't give credit if you don't deserve it. And he deserves credit because as Secretary, he kept quoting that report and talking about why the Department of Health and Human Services needed to be focusing more on health disparities. So you have to, he played, I think, a more integral role in that than many people realize.
Oh, that's so cool. Thank you for that. And actually, thank you for that history, because I was absent some of that for sure. So help me out here. So you're in the 90s now, we're doing pathology. The question for me, if you look back and you look at where we are now in the context of particularly in this month of Black History Month, and thinking about the progress from Carter G. Woodson all the way to the folks in Kent State that sort of said, make it not just a week, but a month, all the rest of those students that, how have we, in your assessment now, where are we now? Have we made substantial progress, more or less the same? When you look at this arc, what's your sense about where we are now?
I think a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I would have said, we've made a lot of progress and we're moving forward. Seeing what's happening in society these days, the lack of hesitancy about espousing racist comments, the way women's health is being looked at today, the way we can't even refer in an application to being Black, we have to be neuter because the Supreme Court doesn't want race to be used, even though we can talk about the effects of slavery. And I mean, I don't care if somebody else who's white wants to talk about the fact, that's fine, but why can't I talk about it, or my friends or my families talk about it? And then seeing what's happening in terms of legal things, it's going to be years before we can reverse some of the problems we're having right now with those who are in legal positions to block some of the progress that we have made by accepting and approving some of the local actions coming from, let's say, those who are less aware of, or really don't want to be aware of, looking at issues of diversity and equal access to health care, equal access to health, equal access to living, really. That's what it's all about. So right now, I hate to say that as I'm coming to the end of my life, and I hope it won't be that soon, but still, it's discouraging because we're fighting the same battles that we fought in the 40s and the 50s. And I can remember those. And the people who lost their lives just so we could vote. I remember the hangings and the lynchings in the South. I remember when, if we drove south to visit my relatives in Tuskegee, we had to drive during the day, and my mother would have to put her head down if we passed a cop because she was fair skinned, so they wouldn't think a Black man was with a white woman. And nowhere to stop. Talk about those boxes of fried chicken. Yeah, because by the time you left Virginia, there was no place to stop to get something to eat till you got to Pascal's in Atlanta. And then from there to Tuskegee, boy, that was a fast hop. Drive down there quickly to get off the road. And we've come a long way since then. And we can drive fine cars and or even poor cars, and we can be with a group of blended complexions in the same car. But all of a sudden now it's getting scary to do that again. And so thinking about what so many people sacrificed for, including my relatives and all of us coming up and what we went through, is just so disheartening to think that young people are having to face that again. When I talk to young folks, and they start talking about some of the insults they get, let's say, in medical school or in hospitals, since we're talking about medicine and areas. And I want to laugh at first and say, you think that's bad. You should have experienced some of what I experienced. But then I can't do that because, to me, maybe it's worse because we've come now 40, 50 years, and the fact that they're experiencing this at all is not good. And maybe it's almost worse because they know that it can be better. We didn't know that it could be better. We hoped it could be better, but we know it can be better now. And so I can't laugh and dismiss what they're going through now, saying, you should have had, too bad. What would you have done if you had been me? Because I'm not sure what I would have done in their circumstances now, knowing that there was hope once, but that hope is being destroyed. I want to be positive, and I think I don't want to give a leave it as a negative message. That is disheartening. What is encouraging to me is that a lot of my generation are beginning to die out, as you know. And I'm thinking right now I'm working on a proclamation for Dr. Edith Mitchell as a past president of NMA,
Man.
and that's a shocker. And I talked to
And
her the
fellow
night.
Virginian and fellow
Yes,
Virginian.
that's right. And I talked to her the night before, just a few hours before she died, and thinking about what she went through. But a lot of us older folks are leaving or going or becoming disabled. But I see young folks, young meaning anywhere from the teens to the 60s, who are not accepting this and who are willing to fight for the rights as their ancestors did. I get fed up with those who say, I don't need to vote. My vote doesn't count. Where are their heads? Where did they go to school? Where are their families? Didn't they learn what it was like coming up? So I have no patience for them, no patience at all.
Yes.
But I have great patience and great admiration and great hope lying in my confidence of those who are coming along, who have got a backbone and who aren't saying, I'm tired already. I go, if you're tired already, imagine how I feel at my age. Gee, with don't tell me you're tired. Get up out of that bench and go do something. Because if you're tired and I'm tired and gone, who's gonna take care of us? Who's gonna look out for us? So unfortunately, we've got some folks who are doing that. And that, so we're raising a whole new generation of leaders, and we just have to support them, encourage them, and do what we can to help them get along and to keep them on their feet and to keep them from being discouraged.
Well, anytime everybody sort of say, my grandfather used to say that he had heard it from someone. I forget what he said. That sometimes it only takes the ability of one person to have courage to stiffen the spine of others around them. I want to say to you, Dr. Penn, that you are that person who actually has that courage that allows many of us to look towards you and some of the others, but certainly towards you and actually get that stiffening of a spine and knowing what it is that we have to do. You know what, you answered my next to last question, which was the hope, what brings you hope. My last question, or maybe my last two, might be, what is the most exciting thing that has happened in the field of medicine since you started as a medical student? Whether it's
That's
a drug or technology or some sort of screening, what has been one of the things that you thought to yourself, now that was something good in medicine?
Well, there have been a number of things, and thinking from my point of view. One, I have to say, after having been the founding director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at NIH, that one of the things is that medicine has come to recognize that there are differences based upon both sex and gender, as well as, if you don't want to use race, whatever our cultural backgrounds are. I don't want to get into that argument over whether race is effective as is a scientific principle, because before it was always, let's use the white man as a norm, and anybody else follows in that. So I think that science and research today have benefited from that change. That's a major change in policy related to research, which has implications for public policy, implications for healthcare, and implications for what we can expect as patients. So I have to say that because I was involved in that. And I think if you think about it, it really has changed the face of science now. So I
Absolutely.
think that's one. Of all the discoveries and I'm not an expert on this, but I think learning more about and finally learning about the genetic basis of disease, especially, for example, I remember I was at NIH when we had that sort of town hall and all got together when they first announced they discovered the BRCA gene.
Yes.
And that was earth shaking. That was earth shaking. And so I can't say I've kept up with all the findings since then, but to me, that started a whole new era in the field of medicine and healthcare, when that genetic basis for diseases led to possibilities of altering or predicting or just understanding more about some of the conditions that have been affecting us for years. So that's not my, I've given you my field, which I think is important. But also, if I just looked at it from the abstract, genetics are not my field. I looked, the guy that taught me genetics in medical school, we're talking about the 60s. I later ran into him and he remembered that he had taught my class, and I went back and looked at my class notes and I had summarized them all on two index cards. So that's about where we were talking back in like 63, 64. So we have come a long way since then. So I didn't start out in that area, but that to me represents probably the greatest area of growth and the greatest area of expansion. I mean, there are some frightening aspects to what we're learning about the genetic basis of disease, but there are also some very exciting aspects of genetic basis of disease.
That's so awesome. I again want to say how appreciative I am for allowing me to spend this time with you.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, a podcast of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at cancerhistproj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.